This week on Lunchbox Envy, we breed 50 billion of them worldwide every year.
They share a common ancestor with the T-Rex.
And Napoleon loved eating them so much, his chef had one roasting on a spit 24/7.
This week, it's chicken.
Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Jack and I'm here with my fellow QI elf, Manu.
Hello. We're also joined by chef and food writer, Rosie McKean.
Hello, both of you.
So chicken, 50 billion a year, that's quite a lot when you consider the mass of a chicken and how quickly they grow.
How many chickens is that per person per year?
8.2, so that's like 6 chickens per person per year.
6 chickens. What do you think? Are you eating 6 chickens
worth?
I'm
not getting through 6 chickens.
I think I'm eating more than 6 chickens.
I was going to say,
year.
I'm definitely eating more than 6 chickens.
Yeah, drunken night out, fried chicken on the way back.
Okay, but if you're just eating the breast, let's say, then you're probably actually eating like 15 chickens worth of breasts, but you're casting aside all the bones and stuff.
Just to say, if you're eating just breast, get in the bin. What a waste of everyone's time.
So how many do you reckon you eat per year?
I'd say 8 to 10.
Okay.
Comfortably. I mean, obviously, my job makes my chicken consumption probably more than the average person.
That is true.
Do you think chicken is the most commonly eaten meat in the world?
Yes.
It must be, right?
I think it might be now. It's between chicken and pork.
Yeah.
Are you going by number of pigs or kilos of meat?
I think amount of...
Kilos then.
Yeah, kilos. Yeah. I think it is still pork, and then chicken is projected to overtake it very quickly.
There are 1 billion Muslims in the world though, and none of them eat pork, right? Most religions allow, if they're going to allow any meat, they allow chicken.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bangladeshi farmers are raising ducks instead of chickens.
What?
Because when the floods come, they float.
Wait, as in like because of climate?
Yeah, because of climate. And also Bangladesh is a low-lying country, which is prone to flooding even before human-induced climate crisis. But yeah, ducks float rather than chickens who just drown. So it's a bit morbid, but like it's quite a clever adaptation, right? Mm. And I think duck's tastier, to be honest. Save that for the duck episode. So the chicken, it originates in the Himalayas as the flamboyant red jungle fowl. But it looks like your typical chicken with its kind of red and green, and it's quite iridescent. And there are still 250,000 of them living wild, but there are 35 billion of them being farmed. So they're way more successful as a source of protein.
I'm really surprised that that's where they come from.
Yeah, the Himalayas.
They seem so unexotic.
They do now, but then why breed them to have pretty feathers that you're just going to pluck off, right? So let's open our first lunchbox, and that is Manu. What have you got today?
I have brought with me my favourite bit of chicken that exists on a chicken.
Can I guess, is it the oyster?
It is the oyster.
So
chicken oysters are two surprisingly oyster-shaped pieces of meat on the back of a chicken just above its thighs. And they're super tender because when you cook the chicken, the juices tend to pool inwards and they kind of cook in their own juices. They've kind of got their own like bone pockets, so you pop these pieces of meat out of those, and people always leave them because it's on the back of the chicken and you're carving the front where the breasts are
hidden from view.
So if you know what's good, you get the chicken oysters. In French, they're called solilès, which translates roughly to the fool leaves it there, because they are so tasty.
You've given the secret away now, so all of our listeners will go straight to the chicken oysters.
Well, and you can then fight over them at the end.
It's going to cause so many divorces.
When I was at culinary school, we were taught how to break down chickens raw and cooked, and they were so specific about, like, make sure you don't leave the oyster out, like, bone that knife around that little dent and get it out. And we would lose marks if we didn't get the oysters off in one go, basically.
Oh, damn straight. They are so good.
They would
so
check that how much flesh was left back on the bird and had you got that oyster.
But
wasn't it also like a butcher's treat before, when people didn't realise how good they were? Butchers would like scoop them out and keep them for themselves, I think.
Yeah, that does not surprise me. They're so good. There was actually the first time I had them, I was waitressing in a kitchen. And we had a dish that was just chicken oysters, and it was the best thing I've ever had.
To be clear, they're what, as big as a broad bean?
I would say bigger than a broad bean, like a 2-pound coin, but obviously thicker than that.
It depends how big your chicken is.
Maybe you've got more on this, that Manu, but the average chicken in the 1920s in America was 1.2 kilos and now it's 2.7. So they've more than doubled in that time. I guess that's like meeting your grandchild and they're twice as heavy as you are. So like my grandchild would be about 150 kilos.
Yeah, scary. BFG vibes.
In the early 20th century, the American farmers turned to the chicken as a source of like an emerging economy and the, you know, way to fuel an army. And so they had this big competition where they had to come up with the best chicken breed to like mass produce.
It's called the chicken of tomorrow. It's really interesting, actually. It's post-World War II when they decided that, oh my God, we need to, yeah, like replenish our population. So they had a $10,000 prize.
Wow.
To produce the chicken breed that would like grow really, really fast and have lots of meat on it. And they came up with two. The purebred one was called a White Rock. And then the best overall breed was a Red Cornish cross. And then they bred those two together. And they produce what we now know as the broiler chicken.
Okay. It's an Americanism to broil, right? It means what we would call roasting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can I ask a quick question, which is sort of related? Okay. How much was $10,000 in today's money? If it was $10,000 at World War II, how much would that have been now?
We can find out.
This is my favourite moment in every podcast I listen to. Is what's that in today's money?
So that is roughly $175,000.
Oh, that is a good... Because I was thinking to myself when you said the prize money was $10,000, I was like, I wouldn't do anything for $10,000.
I'd do some
pretty
things. I need to get out of bed for less than 15K, babe.
So a common trope if someone tries a new exotic meat is that they say it tastes like chicken. Does anyone know why?
No.
So I actually looked into this. So meat, we typically split into either white or red. And red meat contains myoglobin, which is a molecule that makes muscles work. And actually, that's interestingly, when you cut into a rare steak, it's not blood coming out, it's myoglobin. Anyway, so that's what makes red meat red. But chicken is white meat because it has less myoglobin. Chicken is the only non-red meat we tend to eat, which is why when you eat crocodile or frog meat, that's also white meat. So obviously, it's going to be a bit more like chicken. So there's that. And also, chickens aren't bred for their taste anymore. So if you eat especially cheap chicken, it sort of doesn't taste of anything, which is why if you're having something that's texturally similar and also unseasoned, it's going to taste a bit like basically what we expect protein to taste like, which is bland chicken, basically.
Mm.
But if you have a proper chicken that's like all schmaltzy, it really does have its own flavour, which I think is unique.
I think chicken flavour has become so commercialised because now you can obviously buy chicken crisps and obviously like powdered stocks and powdered flavourings of chicken are so prolific and we cook with them a lot. And that's not to say that they're bad. Like I love a Maggi cube. I'm all about them. Mm. But that flavour is really like recognisable, isn't it? Like a roast chicken flavour. Mm-hmm. And I actually did a bit of consultancy work for a company I cannot name. And I had to produce what British roast chicken flavour should taste like because they had a flavour profile that they were using already for a different product, but it was a Spanish version and it tasted noticeably like different to how I think a British roast chicken flavouring would taste.
That's fantastic.
So I made my own version for them to sort of condense down into whatever they were making it for. And I basically roasted up a chicken with loads of butter and a little bit of lemon, a little bit of garlic, and a little bit of sage.
Oh,
and,
okay.
That was kind of like...
No thyme.
I didn't use thyme because thyme, I think, is a lot stronger flavour. And like, I think when you eat chickeny stuff, you taste more of a sage flavour than you do of
thyme.
That's
amazing. Flavor. I didn't know that.
That's my interpretation.
Well, of course, it's your own personal one.
But... When I have had to do work on like this, I have found that sage is a more prolific flavour than you would think.
Interesting.
Yeah, we do love putting it in stuffing as well, like ready-made
stuffing. Exactly, yeah. Paxo, which is a flavour we really associate with roasts and roast chicken. I once had to replicate what a sausage McMuffin tasted like.
Oh, really?
And like, to do that, I used ground up dried rosemary and ground up dried sage in the patty, and it worked so well. And garlic, dried garlic.
Just on fried chicken, where do we think it comes from?
Universal. I think he came from God.
That's fair.
On the sixth day, he made fried chicken. I don't know, actually. I'd guess because I know fish and chips is contended, but I feel like battered fish was quite common in Portugal.
But it was Jews living in Portugal.
Yeah, of course. Who then brought it all over the world.
Yeah.
Which bit of the world do you associate fried chicken
with? Southeast Asia. That's my...
Oh, damn. Okay.
Is that right?
Korea, Northeast Asia, I suppose.
It's Africa, isn't it?
Obviously, with the origins of an ingredient or a food, it's really hard because people love sharing food, love sharing recipes across history. I was gunning for someone to say the southern US, so say like Kentucky Fried Chicken, but there are food historians that think that fried chicken as we know it and associate it with the US actually came over from Scotland.
Wow.
And then what? Traveled over. It's probably not a particularly nice story, but we think that the fried chicken dish was taken over by slave owners and colonists to America. So it traveled that way.
And then became part of African-American culture.
Because they were asked to cook it.
Right.
Yeah, I see.
My God. So like Southern American style chicken actually existed before in Scotland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Right. So there's evidence from 1773 of a fried chicken dinner made for someone on the Isle of Skye.
Ah, yeah. 3 years before independence.
I wonder what herbs and spices they used.
Ooh, probably a secret.
The Colonel's secret recipe.
Let's move on to our second lunchbox, and that is Rosie.
I have brought with me chicken soup. Specifically, Jewish penicillin, aka Jewish chicken soup.
Oh.
My husband is Jewish, and something I've found in our relationship over the years is that I need to have a lot of chicken stock and schmaltz and stuff on standby for him. Wait, I'm going to pour these out.
Yeah, it smells delicious. It's a watery soup with bits of vegetables and chicken in. It's like the good amount of fat on the top, the globules of schmaltz, you said?
Yeah. So I'll tell you a bit about how I made it in a second. First of all, though, what do you think?
Mm.
The smell. So I'm holding it in my hands in a mug and it's already insanely comforting and it smells like home.
It's so tasty. I can't believe it is good for me.
So... Mm. Chicken soup is prolific in Jewish cuisine, specifically is enjoyed around Shabbat, but also Yom Kippur. Basically, in the 12th century, a Jewish philosopher and physician called Moses Maimonides brought the healing properties of chicken soup into the limelight. And he basically said that it could cure asthma, weight gain, and even leprosy.
Wow.
Now, there is... little to no evidence to support that it can cure any one of those things. However, there are some healing properties. It's also important to note that actually the first mention of chicken soup having healing properties goes to a Chinese document dating back to the 2nd century BC, in which the soup is described as a yang food that warms the body and has an invigorating effect. Mm. But it was Mr. Maimonides who's more widely publicized.
Mm. Oh, well, it's definitely something I grew up. I'm not Jewish, but it's just sort of filtered through the sort of multicultural British culture that chicken soup is good when you have a cold. I wonder if it's common to many cultures.
Mm. I think it is. There are some properties of chicken soup that are actually potentially medicinal. I was just really interested in the idea that a food, like something that you create at home, could actually be medically beneficial to you. So... obviously, chicken is a great source of protein, so particularly helpful to your muscles when your body feels weak. Also, when chicken cooks in soup, it releases an amino acid called cysteine. Cysteine can thin mucus in the lungs.
Okay. We shouldn't underestimate the placebo effect either, because it's usually cooked by a family member. And therefore, it just feels like it's cooked with love and given to you as a sympathetic thing. And, you know, I think it's different if you order it on Deliveroo. Like, that probably doesn't have the same effect.
Yeah, you're right. Your mind is programmed to healing by drinking the chicken soup. Like, you're thinking, I'll get better after this.
Someone has made me chicken soup because they know I'm ill and they want me to get better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This chicken stock, I made stock this week. It's one of my favourite activities in the winter.
Same.
To cosy up and make a big vat of stock. And I typically have lots of chicken parts coming in and out of my house. And I will always keep any scrap bone or carcass or anything that I've got. So I had in my freezer a bag of wingtips, a bag of wings, a bag of spines. And that has made this a particularly good stock because wingtips and spines are filled with collagen. Mm-hmm. And that is genuinely really good for you. And ladies, we should all be eating chicken skin and literally wiping it all over us because that stuff is full of collagen. Wow. And it will make our skin lovely and soft and supple. But they also make a particularly good jellified soup. So you know when you make chicken stock and it goes to like jelly, that's because you've used those really good parts of the bone.
Take it out of the fridge and it's wobbly.
Yeah. Chicken feet as well are an excellent chicken stock.
Have you ever eaten chicken feet?
Do you know, I don't think I have, which I'm embarrassed about because I'd like to try them.
Well, there's a place down the road that doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I should have gone.
They are pretty good once you get past the texture.
Yeah, it's more in my head like, you know when you eat, if you've ever eaten tongue, it's the thought of the food rather because the flavour is incredible.
Yeah,
it's
if you didn't know like, what they were.
I have a foot in my mouth. I have a foot in my mouth. Or like I have a tongue on my tongue. There is a tongue on my tongue.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I've never had tongue, but that would be really
It is
weird.
A bit trippy.
You've never had tongue. It's so
super
good.
Tasty.
Well, so you said schmaltz earlier. Do you want to explain that?
Schmaltz is a Yiddish term for chicken fat, rendered chicken fat, which is found in the skin and inside the cavity of the bird. You can actually just pull out like huge pieces of fat if you've got a really good quality chicken. And you cook it really, really slowly so that the fat changes from solid to liquid. Uh-huh. And it goes golden and roasty, toasty. And it's used in lots of Jewish cookery. But also, I generally use it when I can in different things.
Spread over toast.
Spread over toast, like croutons made in chicken fat. Oh, that's some good stuff. You can find a recipe for that in my cookbook.
Oh, very nice. I was going to say, do you ever do the classic like roasting potatoes in a bird fat? Say we normally use duck fat. Mm. Can you do it with schmaltz?
You can, but you need so much. Like the thing about duck fat is that you can actually get a lot of fat off one duck and one goose, for example. Mm. But chicken fat per chicken is a lot less. Mm. Also because it's just woven into the flesh a bit more. Like actually goose meat is quite dry. Oh, all the fat is on the outside. So you don't get the same texture meat. Yeah. My mouth is filled with saliva.
Okay, it's time for our third lunchbox, and that is my one. So I've brought in today the world's first frozen chicken.
Ooh.
It's quite old.
Is it still frozen, though? Is it good?
Yeah. I've been keeping it on deep freeze since 1626.
No.
Yeah, so I actually have to explain the story via bacon. A man called Francis Bacon. Ooh. I don't know if you've heard of him. He was the Lord Chancellor to James I. So we're talking early 1600s. And he was a man of some intellect. Anyway, he was traveling through London with his mate one day. And he saw the snow on the ground. And he thought, I wonder if you could preserve a chicken in snow like you can in salt. Because they learned if you can put meat in salt, it lasts a lot longer before it goes off. So he jumped out of the carriage and he bought a chicken off a local woman. And he killed it and he half plucked it. And then he gutted it. And he basically stuffed it with snow, I think inside and out. And he left it overnight. And sure enough, the next day they chopped it up and cooked it and ate it. And it was fine where it normally would have gone off. Trouble is, he then got ill, either from the snow or from the actually not very well-cooked chicken. And 3 days later, he was put up in a damp bed, but he caught pneumonia and died. So the chicken and the bacon both died from this one experiment, but he invented frozen chicken. And so I think that is one of his one of the things he should be remembered for. And the dead chicken, in fact, still haunts the area around Highgate. It's Pond Square specifically, so if any fans live nearby, they can go and check it out. And there have been three sightings, one in 1943 where a guy tried to catch it and eat it, but then it went through a wall.
This sounds like the Muppet Christmas Carol.
It does sound a bit like that. And one in the 60s and one by a canoodling couple in the 1970s. Hmm. But it's not been seen since, so I don't know whether it's been sort of made its peace and gone to a higher plane now.
Wait, so is its ghost half featherless?
Yes, it's
and
half plucked.
Headless.
I had no word on whether it's headless or not. Mm. But it's definitely half plucked. That was what the all three of the sightings said.
Wasn't there also a thing about that chickens could walk around headless for some period of time?
18 months is the record.
18 months? That's actually horrible. I thought it was going to be like 5 minutes.
I know kids with personality are less than 18 months old.
No, but that's because that example, so it's from the 1940s in America, they beheaded a chicken, but they didn't get the jugular vein. And most of the brain stem was left intact, so it managed to live for that long. But if you actually behead a chicken, it can kind of move around for about a few minutes, but yeah, it will bleed out and die quite quickly.
Was that a deliberate experiment or just some farmer
who sort of
cat-handed attempt at beheading?
A very lucky cat-canned.
Wowee. It became something of a celebrity, actually. Or just from memory, he used to put like corn down its open esophagus to keep it alive.
Gross. Did you guys ever watch the episode of Jamie Oliver where he like grinds up a chicken carcass in front of kids and makes chicken nuggets and is like, would you eat these now? And the
I have discussed this recently. I haven't actually seen it, but apparently they all were like, yeah, we would.
Yeah, because they look great. So there's a Finnish company called Superground that's doing a similar thing. So they're grinding up all of the bony, kind of cartilagey, connectivey bits of chicken, but also of fish. And they're putting it through an extra process. So they're like superheating it and pressurizing it and then grinding up even further. And apparently they can produce 40% more edible protein from a from a chicken.
Wow.
By putting it through this process.
Because sorry to interrupt. Oh. I always thought that chicken nuggets was such a, I mean, they're objectively made of horrible stuff, but it's an amazing way that technology and human intuition has made something that's would otherwise be thrown away into something really delicious. And it's not good for you, but it's like it's calories and it's...
I mean, it's also a protein as well. I think saying that this particular kind of meat isn't good, I mean, obviously it might not be as nutritious or easily available and it needs to be processed. But surely it's better than wasting it.
Yeah, I think the issues come with the processing, don't they? Because I know that certainly in the States, they have a big problem with very loose laws on what you can feed your animals. Like in those massive, like intensive farming situations, the chickens are filled with a lot of chemicals and antibiotics. And that then taken in by humans in a repetitive way can affect your own body. And that's where the problems are. But then obviously there's a huge discussion of like, well, food and availability and poverty and like all of these things play into one another. And basically the whole thing is capitalism's fault.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
I've got something else on not wasting bits of chicken. I found that you can eat coxcombs. So the when you picture a cockerel or a rooster, it's the red frilly bit on top of its head. Not many people in this country, at least, are okay with eating coxcombs.
They love them in Italy.
Oh, really?
They love them in Italy, yeah.
How do they prepare them?
So there's a ragu in Italian food, particularly Northern Italian, called ragu di cortile. Cortile means the courtyard. Ooh. And it's basically like a medieval reference to like the fowl of the courtyard of the... you know, whatever, like, old house you lived in. And it's a fowl ragu, so lots of chicken livers and gizzards. Ooh. And coxcombs and duck parts and basically very delicious and meaty. And there's definitely coxcomb. And they also have a coxcomb shape of pasta.
Yes, I think I've seen that.
Yeah. I can't remember what it's called, though.
I was such a nerd, I used to call them Dimetrodons because I was learning about dinosaurs. Aww. And they were Dimetrodon-shaped.
That's cute, though.
Creste di gallo.
Ah, that makes sense.
Gallo is
chicken.
Chicken. I suppose my only other question before we move on is, what is your favorite chicken dish?
Oh.
Like, gun to your head, you could only eat one chicken dish for the rest of your life. Which one would it be?
Fried chicken, definitely.
Fried chicken.
Mm-hmm.
American style or Korean or?
I mean, Thai style is quite nice. Korean fried chicken is, but like an Asian saucy. Really nice.
Is that triple fried? Because when I tried to make Korean fried chicken, the recipe said to do it three times. That might be how it differs from American style.
American style is typically once, a single fry, but with a buttermilk brine.
Oh.
And then Korean is two to three times. So is Japanese. Karaage.
Oh, yeah. Karaage.
Ooh.
And Taiwanese, which I think is my favorite type of fried chicken, is, I think, twice as well, but I could be wrong about that. It might be only be once. We should go on a chicken tour of
London. Oh my God, a chicken crawl. Okay, that's it for this edition of Lunchbox Envy. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on Instagram at Lunchbox Envy Pod, or you can email lunchbox@qi.com with any questions. Rosie, do you have any favourite recipes in your new book?
Yes, I have popped in there my ultimate roast chicken recipe, which is a spatchcocked chicken over peppers, onions and garlic with salsa verde. And it is spectacular, if I do say so myself.
Oh, no, I agree. Good Time Cooking, available at all bookshops. And we'll leave you with this story about P.T. Barnum, the famous American showman, who in 1856 advertised an attraction at the American Museum in New York. The poster promised a 6-foot-tall man-eating chicken. When visitors paid and entered, they discovered a 6-foot-tall man eating some chicken. See you next time. Bye.
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 Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Manu Henriot, Rosie McKean, and me, Jack Chambers. It was mixed by Li Ying Lee and produced by Alex Bell. This has been a Quite Interesting Podcast.